Welcome to Not Work, Myth, and Storytelling. This is the show where ancestral wisdom meets the modern imagination. I'm your host and lead storyteller, Marisa Gowdy. I'm a myth worker, a story healer, and a writing coach. I'm the author of The Sovereignty Knot, A Woman's Way to Freedom, Power, Love, and Magic, and the founder of the Writer's Knot and Author's Knot communities. On Knot Work, we explore the mythology and folklore of Ireland and beyond. Whether you're drawn to Celtic culture and the power of the landscape, or whether you just like a good story and expansive conversation, you're in the right place. Fáilte. If you love what you hear and want to support the show, I'd be so grateful if you'd become a paid subscriber to my Myth is Medicine newsletter over on Substack. Look for the link at the top of the show notes or visit mythismedicine.substack.com. Before we explore this week's story, I have a question for you. What about your stories? Whether it's a book project that wants to be birthed, deep, authentic writing to support your business, or a personal creative project you can't quite name yet, I'm here to support you through the entire writing process, from the initial ideation stage to the crafting of narrative and beyond. If you're ready to write memoir or a chronicle of the spiritual journey or a book that explores healing, nature, and the power of imagination, as well as the toughest truths of today, call on me. I walk beside you as you uncover the story that only you can tell. I'm a confidant who supports you through the challenges, and I'm your champion who will offer the nudges you need to get the words on the page. And yes, we hold space for the mythical and the magical all along the way. Visit my website, marisagowdy.com, to learn more about my writing coaching services and set up a free 30-minute consultation. Season 6, Episode 16, Stepping Off the Path by Catrice Horsley. I am so excited to bring you this wholly original tale, which has roots that you will definitely remember. Our guest, Catrice Horsley, grew up in the slums of Birmingham, England. Whilst her family were poor in pocket, they were rich in the mouth, and this laid the foundation for her love of words and stories. In her early years, she struggled to be understood due to a speech problem, and this resulted in her becoming a selective mute. In fact, she didn't speak until she was about 8 years old, and her teachers judged her to be, quote, educationally subnormal. She went on to become the UK's National Storytelling Laureate and an internationally known narrative consultant and performer. Catrice believes that this was not in spite of her childhood, but because of it. She is passionate about the power of storytelling and enabling people to know that their voice deserves to be heard and their story deserves to be told. You can find her on her website, narrativesforchange.com, and I definitely invite you to check out her Substack, The Wilding's Path. The link for both of those is in the show notes. Well, I am so thrilled to welcome Catrice here to the podcast today. And as is our way on Knot Work Storytelling, we'll first ask the story to speak for itself, and then we'll explore all the ways that it still matters and resonates in our hearts today. So Catrice, will you tell us a story?
Indeed, I will. This story is a gift for you. Its words are magic, it is true. For words, they help us all combine, and stories help us all to bind together as a humankind, together as a humankind. So let us start. The young girl is standing outside the dark mouth of the cave, and she can feel the wind pushing in through the thinness of her nightgown, and she shivers, but she can't pull herself away. Every single hair upon her body is arched towards the sound that is coming from that mouth. Boom, 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 boom. The heartbeat of the beast. She feels it outside her skin. She feels it inside her skin. She cannot resist. She places one slim, pale ankle over the threshold into the cave, and she falls and she twists and she stumbles and turns down and down and down, twisting and turning, and lands, opens her eyes. And there she is in her bed in her grandmother's house in the forest. Grandmother, she calls, grandmother, I've had the dream again, the dream of the beast. She hears the gentle, soft slip, slap, slop of her grandmother's slippers coming towards her bedroom, and her grandmother humming, Her grandmother's face appeared there in the doorway. Cherry, said the old woman. Cherry, child, all girls your age have the dream of the beast. It's only natural. The old woman came in and sat herself next to her granddaughter, wiped the granddaughter's pale forehead as the almost full moon was shining in through the window. Shh, shh, child, she said. Shh, just breathe. Everything will be fine. She waited until the young girl's breath was calm, pressed her dry lips against the young girl's soft forehead, and left Cherry, her granddaughter, there, nestled in those crisp cotton sheets. Cherry smiled. She loved it here. She loved it here in her grandmother's house that nestled itself like a brooch in the shimmering green shawl of the forest. Here she felt at home. Here she felt safe. It had been like that at home as well, before her father left. But after her father left, well, then things were different at home. And her mother would look at her and spit out words and say, you have his eyes, you know, green, green like the forest. Cherry couldn't do anything about the colour of her eyes. You smell like him. You smell just like your father. And Cherry tried to shower herself and scrub herself so that she would smell better, but it didn't make any difference to her mother, and her mother sometimes would squeeze her a little bit too hard. But here with her grandmother, she was safe. Here with her father's mother, she was safe. Smiling, she pushed herself into the plump pillows, sighed, and slipped into the land of slumber again. In the morning, she was woken, not by a sound, but by a smell. The smell of sweet, sticky, syrupy pancakes wafting up the stairs like they do in cartoons, hooking her under the nostrils, pulling her from her bed, and bringing her tumbling, stumbling, and fumbling down the stairs into the kitchen of her grandmother's house. Oh, what a sight met her eyes. A huge stack of syrupy, sweet pancakes there in the middle of the table. Pots and pans glittering and shining in the light of the sun, and her grandmother's sweet, crumpled face like an old, used tea bag smiling at her. Cherry sat herself down and started to stuff the pancakes into her cheeks. Chew, child, said her grandmother. Chew. It helps with digestion, you know. Cherry smiled. She wiped the birch syrup from her lips. They're delicious, Grandma. I know, said the grandmother. I'm going to go into the forest, said the grandmother, to collect your mother some herbs. You must go back to her today. And while I'm out, I want you to clean the house. Oh, I will, said Cherry. I will clean the house. I'm very good at cleaning. I'm a good girl, Grandmother. And it's true. She was. She was very good at being a good girl. Being a good girl was what Cherry did best. So the grandmother left into the forest. And Cherry picked and plucked and popped up all the things that were on the table, and she washed up and she polished, and she went up the stairs and she shook out the eiderdown in her bedroom, and she went into her grandmother's bedroom and she shook out her grandmother's eiderdown, and there in the corner of her grandmother's bedroom was the forbidden cupboard. She knew she could not look inside. But this time it was open. An inch-wide chasm of temptation kind of whispered her name. Jerry! Jerry! She could not resist. She walked towards the cupboard, and as though in a dream, she saw her hand lift itself of its own accord, reach towards the golden little handle of the cupboard, and she flung the door back, and a riot of red burnt into her retinas. There was a red leather corset, there were thigh-length red leather boots, there was a red feather boa, and there, lying at the bottom of that cupboard, shimmering red as roses, red as rubies, red as blood, a silk cape, a silk cloak. Cherry picked it up. She twirled it over her shoulders. She lifted the hood over her head. She went and looked at herself in the mirror. Oh, the red made her pale skin look paler. The red made her green eyes look greener. The red made her red lips look redder. She loved herself. She twirled and swirled and swirled and twirled and stopped. There in the doorway stood her grandmother. Grandmother, she said, why do you have all these red things? The grandmother smiled. Child, why, that's why they took me out of the village. That's why they thrust me into the forest, for showing them what happens when you step off the path. To find yourself, you have to lose yourself, child. To find new shores, you have to leave the old ones. Cherry shook her head. Grandmother, you and your words, I have no idea what you're saying. But can I keep the cape, please? The grandmother came, tugged it over her granddaughter's shoulders, kissed the young girl on the cheek. Perhaps you can, child. It's the time of your blood. That time has come. But if you do, if you wear this cape, the beasts in the forest, they'll sniff you out. They'll taste you on the air. They'll come for you. Cherry said, Grandmother, don't worry. I have my silver knife. All us girls from the village, we can deal with the wolves. It's not a problem. Then keep it, child, she said. And the two of them went downstairs where there was a basket filled with herbs on the kitchen table. Cherry put her hand under the handle of that basket, lifted it, and the grandmother said, Hold on, child, wait a second. Here's a gift for you, for your blood time. And there in the grandmother's hand was a silver, beautiful, beautiful silver comb with little pearls and garnets and amethysts all around it. Oh, I love it, grandmother, said the girl, and she placed it in the basket. She went up on tiptoe, kissed the old woman's moth-soft cheeks, and went to leave the cottage, and suddenly it started to rain. No, child, said the grandmother, you can't leave now. You can't now is a dangerous time when the sun shines and the rain comes. It's when the wolves have their wedding. The girl said, Don't be silly, grandmother. Those things don't happen. Oh, they do, said the grandmother. They do. I met one, you know. A wolf man. The girl's eyes grew as big as saucers. And what happened, grandmother? She said. Well, me and the girls from the village, we tied him to a tree. And then I went and got raw meat, and I came to him, and I tempted him with the raw meat. And when he moved his hairy, jowly jaws towards it, I beat him and slapped him. And then I tempted him again. I beat him and slapped him. And I tempted him again and I beat him and I slapped him until those hairy, jowly jaws were covered with spit and saliva that grew heavier and heavier and heavier. And when it spattered and scattered and shattered onto the floor, it turned into tiny puppies that ran off into the forest. And so I beat most of the beast out of him. And what happened then, Grandmother? Stuttered the girl. Why? I married him. He became your grandfather, said the old woman. The girl shook her head. Grandmother, there's no such thing. You're joking with me. Child, said the grandmother, it is not the beast with the hair on the outside you need to worry about. It is the beast with the hair on the inside. The girl squeezed the old woman, opened the door and ran out along the path in the rain, the cape over her, the little basket over her arm. And as she did so, she looked over her shoulder and she jumped to the side of the path. Don't, said the grandmother. Keep to the path, Cherry. And Cherry jumped back on the path and danced and pranced and pranced and danced and hopped off the path. Don't. Keep to that path, Cherry. And the girl danced. Don't keep to the path, Cherry. Don't keep to the path, child. The girl continued dancing along the path into the shadows of the forest. Deeper and deeper in, the shadows lengthened. And suddenly, on one side of the path, she saw red flowers like drops of blood, and they were so pretty. And she thought, my mum will love these. And so she stepped off the path and started to gather loads of these red, red flowers that grew in kind of lines like arteries leading her into the throbbing, dark heart of the forest. She picked up one handful, the last one, placed it in her basket, and that is when she heard it. In the distance, coming nearer and nearer, a strange, discordant music. She hid behind a tree and she bent sideways and she saw there, along a path in the centre of that forest, a procession of wolves, all standing on their back legs, some with ruffs around their necks, some playing violins, some playing accordions. The wedding of the wolves. Her grandmother had been right. She peeked a little bit more. Oh, they were so majestic. And the one at the front, he must have been the bridegroom wolf. Oh, he was so tall. So strong, so erect. She could not pull her eyes away from him. And she leant a little bit further than she had intended and stepped on the branch. In one moment, his eyes fastened on hers. He leapt towards her, landed on his back legs and started to dance around her. Slow, slow. Quick, quick, slow, slow, quick, quick, slow, slow. A foxtrot, which is unusual for a wolf. And then he dropped to all fours and he started to sway. And as he swayed, he started to sing. Cherry white. Cherry red, cherry girl whom I will wed. Hear my secret, hear my plea and comb my matted fur for me. Won't you comb my matted fur for me? Won't you comb my matted fur? Cherry. As though in a dream, she felt herself drop to her knees. She saw her hand in front of her dip down into the basket and take out her grandmother's comb. As though in a dream, she saw her hand extend and started to brush the matted, dirty fur of the wolf. And as she did so, she saw it was riddled with lice, and the lice were creeping and sneaking through his fur onto his back. They were creeping along his back towards his ears. They were creeping in between his ears, down to the tip of his snout, and there under his snout she saw his sharp white teeth, and there under his sharp white teeth, the tip of his pink tongue glistening. She was mesmerized. She was hypnotized. She could not pull her eyes away from that pink tip glistening, and the saliva got heavier and heavier and heavier, and dropped to the floor, turned into a tiny puppy, and scattered itself away into the forest. The girl was up. Cherry broke free from whatever magic she had been under, and she started to run, and she ran, and she ran, and she ran, and she heard them chasing her. All of the wolves howling with laughter, howling. Skitter, scatter, scatter, skitter along the edges of the path. And she ran and she ran and she ran under the light of the full fat moon as it was rising fecund in the night sky. She found the path and she did not stop until she got to the village, until she got to her house, until she went to open the door. But the door was locked. Her mother never locked the door. And she banged on the door and said, "Mother, mother, let me in, let me in. I saw the wedding of the wolves. They are following me. Mother, mother, please, I beg you." Silence. She hammered again, the tears hot and salty burning on her cheeks. She saw a movement of the curtain by the window. Her mother's face appeared, pale, wan. Her mother's voice, "You cannot come in, child. The wolves have been. They told me. They told me what you did. You belong to them now. You are theirs. They have your soul. You are of them, just like your father." The curtain dropped. Cherry turned, her back against the door, crumpled to the floor like a limp rag doll. Hugging her knees to her chest, she realized she still had the comb in her hand. It had pierced her flesh. Blood was pouring there. She knew. She had to go back to grandmother. She stood, dressed herself in her determination, put one foot in front of the other, in front of the other, in front of the other, and headed back towards the forest. They were waiting. Skitter, 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 skitter. Either side of the path, in the shadows. She continued. One foot in front of another, in front of another, in front of another, in front of another. By the light of the full fat moon, she followed the path all the way back to the clearing, and there her grandmother's house, and there on the porch her grandmother in a rocking chair. Rocking backwards and forwards and forwards and backwards. The young girl ran towards her, dropped to her knees, pressed her head, her face into her grandmother's lap and said, "Grandmother, grandmother, mother will not let me back. She said I belong to the wolves." "Shh, shh, shh, child. Cherry sensed something behind her. She turned away from her grandmother and, looking over her shoulder, she saw the wolves had gathered, a great semicircle of them, the bridegroom wolf at the front and next to him, a wolf with eyes green, green, like the forest floor. She knew them. She turned back. "Grandmother," she said. But the woman pushed the girl down. That old grandmother stood up. She lifted her arms up to the moon, and nose became snout, and skin became pelt, and nails became claws as she dropped to all fours. An old she-wolf. Leathered paps hanging under her matted belly, she leapt over the girl and landed in front of the wolves. And the old grandmother wolf started to sing. "Cherry white, cherry red, granddaughter to whom were led, hear my secret, hear my plea and comb my matted fur for me. Won't you comb my matted fur for me? Won't you comb my matted fur?" Cherry. The young girl, as though in a dream, felt herself standing, felt herself stepping down from the porch, kneeling in front of the old grandmother wolf, the comb in her hand. And she started to comb the grandmother wolf's flank. She saw the lice there, dancing, prancing. She looked up and said, "Why, grandmother, what big ears you have. All the better to hear you with, my child," said the old she-wolf. "And grandmother, what big eyes you have. All the better to witness you with, my child," said the old she-wolf. "And grandmother, what big teeth you have. All the better to tear you with, my child," said the old she-wolf. And at that point, the old woman pinned down the young girl, and all the wolves leapt on her, and they started to tear and to rip and to rip and to tear and to lick and to tear and to tear and to lick her clothes and her skin from her body, until her own pelt was seen beneath. The young girl wolf pushed herself up onto all fours, raised her snout to the moon, with pleasure. And she ran off with her family, her pack, and all that was left, lying in the silver glow of the moon, was a red cape, red as roses, red as cherries, red as blood.
Wow. Catrice, thank you. You left him speechless, which I think might be a habit of yours. Don't keep to the path. Don't keep to the path. Don't keep to the path. Thank you for taking us, child. Thank you for taking us off the path and into the wild. Oh, what a gift. Thank you. You know, that powerful writing and rewriting that you did and working with those original tales we think we know and then giving us something that both feels immensely new and so much older than the narratives we have trusted ourselves with over the last few hundred years of modernity. I'm just so moved. I barely have words, but I'm going to ask you to speak into the experience of sharing that story. Maybe we'll start there and we'll keep moving on.
For me, I almost created it as an homage to Angela Carter. Angela Carter is one of my absolute favorite authors, and I love magic realism. And there was always something in me. Actually, if I think of the stories and the shows that I create, weaving together traditional fairy tales, they're usually about duty, desire, and death. Those are my holy three. And this idea of what is allowed by the dominant narrative, especially for us as women, for me as a woman, and what is it that is in my feral nature that still throbs in my body and needs some kind of outlet. And so the story was crafted, I suppose, around that sensation, that need to explore what is allowed and what isn't, and what is feral and what is polite, darling, coming from England, cup of tea, two sugars. Thank you very much. Here's the vicar. So how do we inhabit that liminal space between the feral and the acceptable? God's the dominant narrative. I love it. I love telling it. I love the richness of the language. I love the rhythm and the repetition. So for me, it isn't just a kind of an oral or aural sensation. It's such a physical immersion into the richness of it all. I do love it. I really love it.
Well, I feel as if as you were telling, we just got closer and closer, nose to nose and then snout to snout. You know, I'm leaning in and leaning. I'm like, why does my neck hurts? Nope. This is me craning in and coming in and feeling that I needed to be closer to you, even as the parts that were driving me back in that moment. It's like, oh, wait, that subverted that expectation. Oh, she's taking us off the path. Oh, we're going that far. There's lice. Oh, that's how we're going to travel. I mean, that sense of really inviting us into that more than human world as pathfinders, as those little parasitical mites we want nothing to do with, they were our way showers into both that he wolf and that she wolf. Such a magical, magical pathway.
You know, I hadn't even thought about what you've just said with regards to the lice. And yet I was listening this morning, I'm sure it was this morning or it was yesterday, to somebody who's written a book about fungi and what's it called? Parasitic relationships. And the fact is that, you know, we contain 7 pounds of bacteria when we walk around. So that idea of the lice being present and the wolves and the young girl, you know, because she will absolutely have those lice on her body, somehow being the bearers of the truth of what the forest is and what animal is and what feral is.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Hadn't even thought of it in those terms. So thank you for offering me that.
You're welcome. Though I will take us one step further into the lice conversation. The unexpected always comes. Did you know that there are two kinds of lice that live on the human body, and they're the only creatures on the entire earth that theoretically need humans in order to exist?
Oh, yeah. I love the fact it's just the two, isn't it? No other creature needs us. But just
we've domesticated, you know, certain farm animals, et cetera. And, you know, your local chihuahua is probably not going to make it. But generally speaking, at that level, it is only, we are host to two creatures and everybody else would eventually figure it out.
Yeah. I love that. I love it. The beautiful, I'm going to mention it, this amazing book. It's called To Have and To Hold. Mm. I can't remember who wrote it, but you should look it up. And it is all about symbiotic and parasitic relationships. Mm. And the metaphor that the writer uses is that we are essentially parasites on the earth and the earth is our host. Mm-hmm. And most parasites will not destroy their host because they know that's a very stupid thing to do. But she discusses just the most incredible creatures who can only live with and in relationship to another creature, another entity, another host. Yeah. So that's a slight off the path there, but it's an amazing, amazing book to have and to hold. So I've ordered it already. I heard about it yesterday.
I'll look it up and put it in the show notes. Mm. But that does take us into a really sort of perfect direction, I think, because there was that, the distinction between wolf grandmother and uber civilized tamed mother alone behind her curtain, right? And that sense of knowing that as far as mama is concerned, she can live behind her closed door and she will be very fine. Thank you very much. And the distinction of being out with the pack in the forest and grandmother is with that half moon circle of wolves, her brethren, her sisters gathered round, like, well, she's never been caught up in the myth of separation, right? That takes most of humanity by the hand and, you know, throws us behind the castle walls and then behind the town walls and behind, you know, the picket fence.
Yeah.
And she isn't wrapped up in that big lie of our separation.
And I think that for me, you know, you mentioning the separation, for me as a woman, I have fought. That's, you know, our bodies, I'm going to make a vastly general statement and I don't care. I'm so far from caring, I cannot even see it on my horizon. I don't care. So our bodies become colonized by the dominant narrative, I would say around the age of 8. Mm-hmm. For some of us, it might have been younger. But I know that until I was 8, I had no distinction between me, Catrice, and my body. There was no separation. I didn't think, of, you know, I might have hurt my knee, but I didn't see myself in separateness. And then when I got to about 8, I realized that I was being looked at and viewed and judged. There was an external gaze. Mm-hmm. And so then I had to think about the external gaze looking at me. Mm-hmm. And I think what the grandmother personifies is the reintegration of body with self. After a lifetime of us being told it has to be separate, we need to work on our body, we need to work on our ass being firmer, we need to work on, you know, everything that's, well, below and above our necks. So for me, there was a definite, she fully inhabited her self, which included her body, which was of her body.
So I want to explore that scene where she's looking at herself in the mirror, because there's something that's got its hooks in me and it's not quite speech ripe, but that sense of looking at herself when she had the red made her love herself.
Yeah.
And that feels like a play of that coming, that it's shifting the gaze, looking upon herself, coming back into relationship in a nuanced way that feels like that's what comes as part of a rite of passage, perhaps.
Yes, that's what should come. You know, every girl, when they start menstruating, should be able to look at themselves and go, I am gorgeous. Mm-hmm. Wow. My red makes me beautiful.
Yeah.
That is not happening.
Yes, as a mother of a 15 and 11-year-old, I will be able to tell you from the front lines, it's not.
Yes, yeah, yeah. But, you know, the shame and You know, I don't know. I'm postmenopausal now. As I think I said to you in one of our previous conversations, that my ovaries have dried up so much, they're like little maracas, and I create my own rhythm, so I don't have to follow a 28-day rhythm anymore. And as all of my hormones have changed and my oxytocin has kind of disappeared, so I don't really care so much about others, as I don't put them in front of me as much as I used to. I can put myself first now. But I do find that I am filled with such, and fury is not too strong a word, fury, that we are still battling shame and stigma over menstruation, that girls are still not going to school, that women's bodies are still completely undervalued in terms of medical research, endometriosis, you know, all of the other stuff.
Yeah.
And yet without us, we are, without our wombs, without our ovaries, we cannot continue as a human species.
Yes.
So I am very, 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 very annoyed that we're still fighting that fight.
And I so appreciate that sort of shout from the other side of the horizon, because I am very much in the thick of the perimenopausal moment, which feels like those sort of liminal spaces right now in one of those ways where if we've got, you know, girls just coming into puberty and as women are making this transition out, it's like, yes, it is both raining and sunny all at the same exact moment. Here we are at that liminal space where, oh, I think I hear a wolf. Is that I think it's a wolf. Yes, it's a wolf. And haven't yet fully gotten into the dance, but I know every step takes me closer, as it does with any, you know, young woman in her own moment of change.
Yeah. I wish it was I wish that collectively we could make the whole thing more beautiful. And you know, I think of myself as a seed scatterer in many ways. I throw out seeds in with the work that I do. And the stories that I tell, and sometimes they land on ground that is rich and fertile and they will spring into growth straight away. And other times it's just on ground that they will never have a chance. But I wish that we could all collectively throw seeds to create beauty around menstruation and around what it is to menstruate and what it means that we have the cradle of creation within us, you know? Do you know a lovely fact? I'm thinking about seeds and casting out seeds. This is a slight detour off the path again. I do a lot of work around biomimicry. So when I design training courses and deliver training and stuff for leadership and things, so not so much for storytelling, I use biomimicry as a way of helping me develop those processes. And for seeds, only 16% of any kind of broken landscape, whether there's been a volcano or an earthquake or a tsunami, only 16% needs to be revegetated. And then that 16% by itself will naturally spread out and cover and heal all of that land. And the way that people are doing it now, you know, following that biomimicry, because they, you know, there's some brilliant biomimicrists who are experts, an amazing woman whose name I can't remember, but perhaps I'll send you the things and we can put it in the show notes. She says you can see it in nature that there'll be a stick left in this like desolate field. And then a bird comes and poops on the stick. And then the seeds start to grow. And the first seeds that will grow are the weeds that cover the top surface, and it pulls and keeps safe everything underneath that top surface, which is like a scab on our skin. That's how we, our bodies actually heal. And then the bushes can grow, and then under the bushes, the trees can grow. And so you only need so many pooping sticks in the field in order for the whole landscape to come back to life. So what I'm thinking of us all as are pooping sticks. Yeah, pooping sticks. Just 16% of us all, and then we can make the big difference in creating beauty around periods, menstruation, and all that it means to have those things.
So we'll just simply name this episode, Are You Willing to Be Initiated as a Pooping Stick? And this will just be the number one episode on Apple Podcasts, and it'll go around the world. Or maybe we'll use stories with corsets and red leather boots and wolves, because it might be an easier way to get in as a bit of a Trojan wolf than, would you like to accept the position as pooping stick, dear creative? Well, it's so funny because as you're telling the story, I'm thinking of so many women I have the deep pleasure to know as writers who are in my writing groups and who I get to work with, whose stories just resonate at some of the similar notes within yours. And it's that sense of, you know, knowing that we, in some ways, we live in a very finite earth and we have to recognize we must live within it. And in other ways, we live in a world of abundance beyond our greatest imagining. Mm. And that abundance comes in from saying, oh, here's another voice in the chorus of how we can claim and reclaim and find ways to be what still is that beautiful, gorgeous, difficult struggle to be part of the 16%, because we are working up against a very big monolithic narrative, a very patriarchal, all those things that we know the narrative is. But I just adore that somehow that these brilliant writers I'm thinking of are brilliant writers and thinkers and dreamers. And they're also pooping sticks.
Yes. I think that this is the new show that I'm working on is called Mythsilium. Yeah. And it is, you know, looking at myths as the mycelia, the mycorrhizal networks of what of us as humans. Mm. And I think so many of us are doing this. You know, I see it on Substack all over.
Yeah.
And I think there is a real generosity there. Mm-hmm. I also feel that sometimes there is a real people feeling threatened there. Mm-hmm. Oh, mm-hmm. They're doing what I'm doing. So, you know, mm-hmm. they're a threat to me.
Right.
And I take this back to the dominant narrative, which I keep on going back to. I call it the spell. We are under the spell of the dominant narrative. That men, vast generalization again, can show anger and get, you know, well, are you taking over my work and blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. And then there can be, they, you know, they are allowed to be angry. Mm-hmm. And we were never allowed to be angry. Mm-hmm. You know, woman, kind, polite, nice, take up less space. I know it's not all of us, but the dominant narrative, be kind, be pleasing. A good girl is a quiet girl, et cetera, et cetera. I was brought up Catholic, so like double that. Yeah.
I see you there, sister.
Oh, yeah. Irish Catholic. Oh, there you go. Uh-huh. And what we were allowed was bitchiness.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I refuse it. I will get angry if I want to get angry. I will not be bitchy and backbiting and jabby. Mm-hmm. So I think if we are annoyed that somebody's done something, you know, then be annoyed and own that. Mm. Because I tell you what, old Grandma the Wolf, she wouldn't be bitchy. No, she would be furious and she would show it in a way that was good and empowering.
Right.
With her old leather caps.
Yeah. Oh, I loved them. And I love the irony of course, bitch comes from dog, right? Like that sense of, it's just... Like, of course, this the levels of reclaiming and rewriting that are happening within this story to say, no, Wolf Mama's furious. Mm. Mm. Because she has, I mean, and perhaps, you know, we referenced the Chihuahua before. Maybe the female Chihuahua is a bit bitchy because she's quite tiny and she's got to do what she needs to do. Is it a matter of domestication of the wolf into the dog that turns that word into the derogative for women, and also a habit, because let's be honest, like that is that behavior, however we name it, does exist within women who cannot show true anger.
Yeah, which is almost all of us. You know, so many of us struggle to be angry. I was foul as a child. I had the worst temper. And because I couldn't speak as a kid, I was a selective mute. So I was this, and my hair, I mean, I look like the bush of being pulled through backwards. So this like wild hair, silent, furious child. So I had this terrible, terrible, terrible temper. Mm-hmm. And my mom would have to lock me in the bedroom. I remember one incident where there were some girls over the road who were picking on me and my sister. And I ran up the entry into the outside toilet. We had an outside loo and picked up the mop that my mom had used to wipe up all the dog pee. And then I rushed back out and I just shoved it into one of the girls' faces. And I felt such a sense of satisfaction. I was probably about four. It was great. So that was like that little wildling self, you know? And then suddenly at some point, it's like, no, you can't do that anymore. And you repress it, compress it, depress it, suppress it. And the most toxic words are the ones that we do not speak because they poison us from the inside. So I think it is about time that we howled.
Yes.
I think we need collective grieving. I think we need collective howling. I think we need collective joy. And I think we need collective strength.
Yes.
All of those have to be present. None of them can be denied.
Right. But we put away the grief and the anger and move toward, well, let's focus on joy and strength because, well, I'm a coach. I'm a this, I'm a that. I'm a professional optimist. It's actually part of the brand. I need people to ask me to help them learn how to lead or learn how to craft their book. I better show them that I believe we're all going to be more than okay. Everything's great.
Yeah.
My face hurts from that sort of smile.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it is perhaps one of the most damaging things that we inhabit now is the binary when everything is liminal. And we are sold before and after stories. We are sold, I don't know, you know, I was really thin and then I got fat, or that I was really fat and then I got really thin, or I was really unhappy and then I got really happy because I worked out, whatever it is. And actually the presence of that messy, pendulous, backwards and forwards, tearful, liminal time is the truth of it. Right. I actually completely believe that I will never be perfectly happy. I think I will have moments where I feel great joy, and they may well be followed by moments where I feel great sorrow. And that is what living is.
Yes. And that's both, it's revolutionary and it's also such a simple truth that says we live beyond our happy endings. Because we do not know what happens on the other side of death. And we live in a culture that says death is not something to be celebrated, most likely. It is something to be feared. And it's a question I find I come to with many writers I work with is, well, what is, especially in a book that's a creative nonfiction that might be in the realm of something like, you know, shelved in self-help, but is so much more than that sort of thing. And asking that question of, well, what is the ending of this? What is the happy ending of this? Hopefully, and the question truly is, there is no happy ending to this, but what have you been envisioning and now need to really sit with and tear apart and get to know from the inside that says, this is where a conclusion might be for this particular way of expressing ideas?
Yeah. I love that there's a lot of kind of personal memoir happening now with people who have great illness, you know, that they've chronic illness and are very incapacitated because of it, because it's very much about the liminal, the space that we inhabit in between. And for me, I live in Sweden now, and I've got what's called a mir. It's a mire. It's like a little bit of a boggy area, but it's not like a bog. It's just the soil is like a sponge. And you walk through, and there's trees, and all these trees are twisted because there's not enough nutrients in the soil because there's too much water in the soil. And everything is decaying, which means that it is living, because to decay is to be broken down into something else that is living. Yes. And I keep on thinking about this as I get older. I'm 62 now and I have some health issues. And I'm thinking about the incredible life that is found within decay. How wonderful that is.
Do you know Sophie Strand's The Body is a Doorway? Yes. So I was at a reading that Sophie did just on Friday night, because she and I live about 45 minutes away, apart from each other. And she was talking just about the pain of writing that particular book and how she could do it in bursts and then needed to take long breaks, because that sense of, you know, when you are in a story and inhabit a story, what that does to you. And you're thinking about it from many levels. But what she mentioned in it as she was passing through that, and thinking, well, her current projects are around romanticy and really going deep into these cosmic feeling love stories. Mm. And of course, she's got the mycelial concepts to the core. But what I took from her and speaking about that was really that sense of looking to the work that brings us the most joy and passion and pleasure on the page. Mm. And coming from Sophie, who has written The Body as a Doorway and has written so eloquently on Substack and elsewhere about illness and moving through everything she's had to in her life, it offered that sense of right for the joy with a new sort of tenor. It took it from a different place, right? It's that sense of remembering that sometimes we have to write through the most difficult and as well as the joy, but not to skip that part, perhaps.
Yeah.
You know, I guess certain stories have more resonance when told from certain mouths, when you know what else is part of them.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
When you and I last spoke, you said something that was so powerful, and hopefully I can capture it right in this moment. But the distinction between as a writer, as an oral storyteller, and that sense of as an oral story is really, I think as you might describe it, all forward motion of moving through. Like when we meet Cherry, we learn her as she's moving through the story rather than working on the page where so much is about the backstory and the exposition and that character arc. I think you might have even given us a distinction, it was you and I, a distinction between the two. Can we go there for a little bit?
Yeah, I said that oral storytelling is action-driven and written storytelling is character-driven.
Yes.
So, and in many ways, I think it had to be action-driven, oral storytelling, because it had to appeal to everybody. Mm. So you say there was once a man, and then every man goes, that's me. Yeah. You don't say there was once a man who worked for Volvo Cars and right. because, oh, yeah, it's not me. I never worked for Volvo. I work for Ford, whatever it is. So by being action-led in general, then everybody is part of that journey with you because they can all imagine themselves within it.
Yes.
The emotional authenticity, and I keep on coming back to this time and time again when I'm training people to tell stories, the most vital part is the emotional authenticity of the character as they're going through the actions.
Mm.
There are certain people who might struggle with, I don't know, the an anger or lust or sensuality and inhabiting that in the way that the character would inhabit it. So you're not talking about the character feeling something, but you are inhabiting the feeling so the audience, for the audience, it's palpable.
Oh, I love that. Every time I talk to you, I feel as if part of me needs to go back in time and revise every story I've ever told in any other way. And I'm like, and breathe and say, we grow from here. It's action driven as a storyteller rather than going back to my own backstory and the recrimination and shame that is absolutely useless. It's just instead an opportunity to breathe deep and begin anew. And that is so much of what I find in talking to you. I feel like I've known you for years. We've met a couple of times at this point. I feel like
it's
I'm talking like... like in our deep history back in, you know, the early 90s, you know, that's not what we're talking about. It was last week. But Catrice, your work and your perspective and your story and your voice are such a gift. And I'm so, so grateful to have just, I don't know, I feel like we just began that we've looked at the very top layer of the bog today in our conversation and in your just gorgeous story.
I can't tell you how I might cry again. I can't tell you how much that means. It really does, because it is a solitary existence in many ways, which is bizarre when you do this work, because you do connect with so many. But that connection, it tends to be in one direction. And you know, I get emails and things back, but it's a lot of giving and a lot of emptying of my well, which I love doing. Why have a well if you don't empty it? But God, it is truly, truly beautiful to have your words drop into my well and fill it up. Thank you.
Oh, Catrice. Well, we'll leave it there for now. I'm going to invite you back again. And I think that will be something that everyone who listens to Knotwork will be deeply excited to know. But for now, we will just dwell in this particular well that we have filled and emptied and filled again. And I'll just express my deepest gratitude. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for tuning in to Knotwork Myth and Storytelling. Please subscribe and review the show on your favorite podcast platform, and do share this episode with other lovers of mythology and story. By the way, everyone is a lover of mythology and story, even if they've forgotten. Creating this show is a labor of love, and your support will help me continue to craft and share stories throughout this season and beyond. Please consider becoming a paid subscriber to my newsletter, Myth is Medicine, over on Substack, where you'll find new writing and conversations each week. You can find out more about my writing, my book, our online writing communities, as well as how to work with me as a writing coach at marisagowdy.com. Gratefully, I live, write, work, and record this podcast on the ancestral lands of the Munsee Lenape tribe, whose name means original people. Music on this show is performed by Beth Sweeney and Billy Hardy.